What we can model for our kids is that we're a mess, that we're messy and imperfect and human, and that we make mistakes and we snap, and then we figure out how to live into being able to apologize.
Hi, everyone. This is Dana Black.
And this is Chelsea Simon.
Welcome to the collective table.
Hi, everyone. It's Chelsea. Well, it's no secret that our world is plagued with some complex and troubling issues. Climate change, economic justice, racial divide, and violence. The world can be a scary place. As Christians, we are not given permission to escape these realities. In fact, we are called to face them head on and work to dismantle them. But how do we do that? How do we work to bring about God's kingdom to earth? How do we give and live in hope? These important questions are the very thing our guest today wrestles with on a daily basis. Lydia Wiley Kellerman is a writer, editor, activist, and mother. She is the editor of G's Magazine, which explores the intersection of activism, art, and spirit. She is also the editor of the recent book, The Sandbox Revolution. This powerful collaboration highlights different authors and their calls upon collective wisdom to wrestle with the questions, navigate the challenges, offer concrete practices, and remind parents of the sacredness of this work. Lydia offers valuable insights, thoughtful reflections, and honest critiques of our current culture. But what she really does is gives us permission to think differently about our participation in the world. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. So let's start with a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? What was there a faith tradition? I know just reading some of your from your book and from about a little bit about you, you've had an interesting childhood compared to other people.
I have. Yeah. So I live in Southwest Detroit. My partner and I have two boys who are 8 and 5, and we live on the same street that I grew up on. So my dad is still 5 houses down, and my sister and her kids live downstairs. Yeah. And I delight in that sort of long history, knowing that it's the same dirt that my kids are eating that I ate, you know, decades earlier, and really value that sort of that place-based commitment. And a lot of the folks in the neighborhood are folks that I also grew up with. I was part of the Catholic Worker community in Detroit. Catholic Worker was founded in New York by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin. So connected to a house of hospitality. And there were 15 couples who were having kids and saying, how do we stay in the city, and how do we make this sustainable for families? And so we ended up on the same street together, all in our own homes, but sharing commitments to going to mass in the living room of the Catholic Worker, doing resistance and protest together, having a commitment to simplicity and to relationship that I'm just has continued to form me. So yes, I did grow up with a spiritual background. My dad's a retired Methodist minister, and my mom's father was an Episcopal bishop. And then I grew up going to mass at the Catholic Worker. So I was actually baptized all three traditions at the same time, which was such a huge gift to me to be able to sort of see the gifts that were in all of the traditions, and also feel some freedom there, and an ability also to say, here are the things that are real struggles in each of these traditions, and how do we name them and struggle with them, but also be able to find deep spirituality and gifts within each.
Lydia, you talk about the Catholic Worker movement, and there may be some folks who are listening who are new to Christianity or who aren't familiar. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and what was unique about it?
Yeah, so it's a movement that started in New York back in the 30s, and there was a real commitment to hospitality. So they opened homes in the city. They started a food line. They would let folks come and stay as long as they needed. They were also committed to the newspaper. So the idea of sort of education and intellect and study was also really important to go hand in hand with the work of being in solidarity with the poor. And also resistance. So what does it look like, particularly, I think, around anti-war movement, anti-nuclear stuff for a long time has been a part of that. So now there's just sort of these loose collections of houses all over the U.S. and all over the world who each define that differently. It's a very sort of anarchist movement that people define it as their community is, and people do different types of hospitality and resistance. But all those are pieces of it. So for us, the house in Detroit, for a long time, did hospitality for women and children who are on the street. And then there was also a commitment to doing resistance in the city, depending on what the current struggles were. And that was a real gift. I think partly what that taught me personally was that's where my faith journey was, in that I learned the liturgical year by where we put our bodies. So we would spend Good Friday on the streets of Detroit walking and naming where's the execution happening today? What does crucifixion look like in our movement? Is that the media? Is that war? Is it in education? Is it in white supremacy, police violence, sort of naming those places that are happening right now? And then we'd spend Advent every Monday in Advent vigiling outside Williams International that was building engines for cruise missiles. And so resisting nuclear weapons just by holding candles and being present. And so it sort of each season we were putting our bodies in different places. And so that the liturgical year became very embodied in me and connected to justice. There was a real connection of faith and justice that couldn't be separated.
I was going to say, it was a very physical and spiritual space.
Yes, exactly.
So it's like, it sounds like the faith and justice were always interconnected for you. I mean, you didn't have one without the other. How has that, you know, formed you as an adult? How does that shape the way that you parent?
I mean, in some ways it informs everything. I often think like anybody can do justice. You don't have to be a Christian, obviously, to do justice work. But I don't think that you can be a Christian without doing justice work. That those, you can't read the gospel and, you know, hear Jesus's stories of going in and turning over the tables in the temple and challenging the economic system and having women in leadership and being on the margins and, you know, preaching an idea of a world that was so threatening to the powers at that time that they needed to execute him. You know, that is hand in hand part of the work, no matter what. So I think it does, you know, it's a different moment with my kids in terms of spirituality and Christianity. There's so much toxic Christianity right now that it's a struggle to figure out how to talk about Christianity with our kids, how to still sort of hold that spirituality and that history while also naming the ways that so much of the narrative of what we see right now in Christianity is entwined with nationalism and patriarchy and white supremacy. But it certainly does with my kids. I mean, I think every moment in the world that I see begs the question, what does it mean for my parenting? So I see what's happening, you know, the storming of the U.S. Capitol by white supremacists. And I say, what does that mean for me as a parent? And I hold this crisis of the pandemic and it says, what does that mean for my parenting? I see another police shooting and another mass shooting at a school. And it begs these questions of what does that mean for my parenting? All of these decisions that we make as parents are so intimately personal, but they're also political. They exist in this web of systems from where do we send our kids to school? Where do we live? How do we talk about spirituality? How do we talk about race? All of these things are political decisions as well as personal. So I think those questions are sort of always aching in me.
One of the things that I feel has come up even in the work that we're doing, especially in a congregation, is you can't separate the political from the social there's certainly the toxic Christian message, but then there's also those who are like, no, we need to separate those two. We need to come in and hear the message and not be political about it. And what I hear from you is, yeah, that's not possible.
Yeah, I agree. There is no message.
Just want to be really clear.
Yeah. I mean, even if your message is as simple as love one another, that's political.
It's political.
You want to talk about healing people on the margins, that's political. Like, there's no way to avoid that.
Yeah, and it does almost feel like we've cheapened it to make it such an individualistic, like, yeah. How do I save my soul? How do I get to, like, that has become the, like, the main part of Christianity. And it's like, well, to do that is to ignore all of what Jesus said and did. But I think that's part of what you're saying is this toxic Christianity, which has become so individualized. So in all of your justice work, for someone that is new to this, you know, what does justice mean? Like, how would you define justice?
Whew, that is, such a big question. And I love both of your answers on that too, because I don't think there is any, you know, one right answer, and we all keep collectively defining it, and it keeps growing, which I love. You know, like, I think about that in my own writing a lot. It's like, eventually I'm going to look back and I'm going to regret what I've written, because it's not going to hold up. And it's like, it shouldn't hold up, because our definitions of justice are going to keep expanding and growing. And that's a good thing.
That is good.
But I think it's a place. Justice is when our bodies, hearts, and souls are whole, all of us. And so that involves economics, that involves education, that involves respect, that involves dignity, that involves family. I mean, all of those things are part of it. It involves questions around violence, but when we can all be whole.
I think that answer will hold up.
Yeah, I think that answer holds up. Yeah. I mean, that's a gospel answer right there. I mean, it's like, you know, justice is, it goes back to, justice is absolutely connected and woven into the gospel message, because as broken people, for us, you know, to find wholeness with God, God wants, desires us to be whole, is justice. It is justice. So that is just, yeah, I think that holds up. I think you're I'm not sure we can add much to that piece of it. With your, and I don't know how much with the 5-year-old, with the 8-year-old, do they ask questions? Are they curious about what's happening in the world, or as things, as you're trying to explain it? What does that look like as a parent to try? Like, I'm working with a 13 and a 15-year-old, and, you know, but here you have a 5 and an 8-year-old, and they're seeing or hearing things. How do you function with that? What do they ask?
They both do, for sure. I think that it's sort of unavoidable, and kids' questions are so good. they're brilliant and wise, and they see things that I think so many of us eventually are taught not to see anymore. So I think being able to really pay attention and honor their questions and keep asking them questions back is so important. Yeah. And I also think trusting our kids and kind of getting a sense of what they need and where they are. And so my kids are different, where my 8-year-old has always been really hungry for knowledge and for information and sort of wants to go really deep. And my 5-year-old is really empathetic and like feels things really deeply. So he's like, he wants to know, and then he might need to walk out for a little bit, and being able to sort of trust where each of them are. But also talking about things. And I think that's one of the things that I learned growing up that I'm most grateful for about my parents is a willingness to tell us the truth. So we would be going to, you know, anti-war rallies as toddlers, and they talk about it. This is what war means. This is what it looks like. And I feel really grateful for that. And I think there were a lot of parents that were like, you're crazy. This is not okay. Let kids be kids. And I think that's a constant tension. But I also think trusting our kids with the truth is a real gift and a way of honoring them. So I think being able to take those questions and honor them as honestly as we can in a language they can understand is really important. I think just sort of looking at the recent times and sort of the questions that they're asking, I think about, you know, the pandemic was huge and hard continues to be. And I hope we're getting to a point where we might be seeing the other side of it. But we were really honest about that too. And I think about things early on, it was springtime when it first came, and our apricot tree was in blossom, and I pulled off some twigs and put them in a vase, and I would tie on the names of people who we started to hear had the coronavirus or were in the hospital, and just sort of names kept getting added. And that was sort of a visible sign of the pain and the grief that was happening. And then we were also outside in our neighborhood thinking about, okay, that, you know, we've spent, you know, a long time getting to know our neighbors, and this is the kind of moment that that's for. And so we started meeting outside every day at 5 o'clock, and we started checking in on elders and, you know, checking in who was checking in on who to make sure folks were okay. We started collecting wild plants and making herbal medicines and saying, you know, we're going to be our first line of defense. And, you know, my 5-year-old learned how to do a 2-wheeler at 5 o'clock to 30 people on the block cheering him on. And it was like, there's ways both to hold the pain and the grief and also to find joy in the crisis and to find resilience. And same thing, I think about like Black Lives Matter, the best questions are when there's experience. So we go to a Black Lives Matter rally and they have questions, and to be able to take the time to answer those. And same thing with climate change and questions around that. It's like, how do we just spend time with the earth, and the questions come up? And so I think there's the talking and the questions and that are really important, but being able to give experiences that birth those questions and being able to, again, sort of have that embodied experience, something that kids are so good at. And so all we have to do is take them places. Some of the rest of the stuff kind of pours out.
And I think what I hear from you is one, intentionality, right? It's an intentional, and it's not, you're not doing. So one of the things that we could talk, you know, I think that we want to talk about is just, you know, how do parents incorporate this? You're doing things, and some things are obviously larger than other things, but just the fact, I love what you said, is that you went out to the tree and took a branch of it or a blossom of it. And that became the visual representation of people that were suffering and or dying from COVID. I mean, it's not like, you know, it was just the thoughtfulness and the intentionality of, there are people suffering. How do we as a family acknowledge that? So I don't know. I like that. I'm not, it's, you know, that was an easy thing to do.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I really think there's just so many, I don't think we have to put a ton of pressure on ourselves to do all of the right things. There's a simple millions of ways to do things, and we can't really go wrong, but we can just take the little steps that we have. And I, you know, with the branches, it's like, that's something I needed. I knew that I needed to ritualize this somehow. And so being able to say like, that could also end up being really good for my kids to what's, yeah. What do we need together?
Well, I think what you say is like honoring them with the truth is, I mean, at age appropriate ways is a way to have them not, you said something about like adults have learned to ignore these certain things, and to help our kids to be honest and authentic is to like not to shelter them from that. So they don't grow up to be adults that ignore those things, because it's learned behavior to ignore those things.
Yep.
Let's get into the book. I love the title Sandbox Revolution. When I saw that pop up, I was like, I got to get my hands on that. How did you come up with this idea? Like, what did you think the world needed this? And what was that like?
Yeah, well, I think it started as a very selfish project. I needed this book. I started dreaming it up in the early years when my kids were toddlers and infants, and I felt completely sleep deprived and exhausted and really sort of hungry for company in these really hard questions I was holding. What did it, you know, in my context, it's like, what does it mean to raise 2 white boys in this particular moment of white supremacy and patriarchy? What does it mean to raise kids in the midst of climate change? How do we have these conversations, and how do we hold them together? And so I said, I gotta gather a circle of people who I love and respect and just love the way that they walk in this world to say, tell me some stories, help us think about this together and vulnerably to share. In a way that I think we don't often share about parenting because it's so personal.
The book really covers a lot from money to education to spirituality to where you live to, I mean, it covers this whole spectrum of questions. That's just so interesting that we were talking about earlier that we've, as adults, have maybe even learned to ignore somewhat. And when I was reading through the book, I was like, I don't even think I would ask that question. And now that I'm asking it, what are the possibilities are so expansive.
And I think that was my hope, was like that this is not a book that's like, here's your 10 easy answers. You know, it's not like a how-to curriculum, but that it's folks who are saying, here's some questions to ask. And there's certainly wisdom and possibilities and imagination in it that I think are really practical that we can all try. And I know there's so many ways that each one of these chapters has seeped into my life. But I think that's the work. It's like, how do we just keep asking the questions out loud? And how do we do that in community with one another?
And I just want to say, I think I appreciate it, because in the introduction, before you even get to part one, the last thing you write is, we're not perfect, right? We're running, you know, we run into limits. Our process was not perfect, but it was honest and meaningful. And you're encouraging parents to be gentle with themselves. We're not shaming people here. Be gentle. Go into this with curiosity and a desire to learn and grow. And so I personally appreciated that intro. And sometimes people don't read the intros, but I would encourage people read that, because it really helps to frame your intentionality as you go into the space.
Yeah, we're human. We have right. to honor all that messy, beautiful humanness and to love one another and be gentle in it while we're also pouring out our love on kids and this world.
Amen.
Well, we are human, but as parents, I feel like so often we don't allow or we just hold ourselves to this standard. I think especially yeah. as women, like, just there's this standard of like perfection or messing up that just, you know, it's unrealistic and dangerous and detrimental in so many ways. And yet we continue to do that to ourselves and to each other, I think, even. And
so true.
And our kids see that. Our kids see that.
Right. That's what I was going to say too, is that that's what we can model for our kids, is that we're a mess, that we're messy and imperfect and human, and that we make mistakes and we snap, and then we figure out how to live into being able to apologize and to change and to.
Yes. Yeah. Being able to apologize. That's a great lesson to teach our children. When we say we're sorry, they learn that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I remember reading this quote once that's like, you're watching your parents grow up. And I'm just like, oh, and if we could do that authentically, like, and not try to hide that from them, that we're growing up and evolving and, you know, that change is part of human nature, that how much more easily they could adapt to change and, you know, things changing.
How do you think parents can reevaluate our techniques and not judge ourselves? Use some of the things that you're hearing and reading in this book and be gentle.
I really feel like one of the main ways we can do that is through community. How do we ask these questions and share these stories with people? And that's sort of like a common thread that sort of happened unintentionally in the book, is how many folks are like, find yourself some people. Like, when your kids come home and there's a challenging race thing that's happened at school, who can you call to like talk it through? Like, who are the people that can laugh at your mistakes? And I think the more spaces we can create to just vulnerably hold those conversations, the more chance and the more creativity. You know, it's like, I can only think of so many ideas, but if I'm in a circle of people who are brilliant and wise, and you ask questions and you go down these rabbit holes, and suddenly there's so much more possibility for how we can parent and what that can mean and what it can look like, and other adults who might be way better at loving our kids in a particular way than we are. And so how do we sort of continue to expand the bounds of family and the bounds of who's loving our kids and teaching our kids? Because there's so many folks out there that can teach in different ways than we can.
And actually, as I'm thinking about our entire conversation here, one of the other themes I'm hearing from you is community, starting from your early childhood life with the Catholic worker movement and your parents, moving to where you are today. Even when you were talking about COVID and saying it gave us an opportunity to go outside, we knew our neighbors, but we found time, 5 o'clock at night, to just connect in that community, even if it was outside away from one another, but just to check in, hey, so-and-so, are you okay across the street? And now you bring it back to community with the book. So that's definitely a theme that's crystal clear here.
Yeah. And I think it has so much impact on our justice work. So I think about knowing my neighbors, and, you know, kids have this way of forcing you to get to know people because they're going to spend hours and hours outside. And you're like, well, all right, I'm going to stand here while you bike down the street. And now I get to talk to my neighbors and I can ask questions about the history of the block and who these folks are. And I think it's so often relationships that push us into justice work. So, and I see that continually through my life of like, because I love this person, I can't not act, right? It's not a choice. It's an act of loving them. That's now, you know, I'm now marching for immigration justice in the street because I love my neighbor. And how does that look? And I think more and more, that's what I'm finding with my kids is who they are, and loving them is constantly changing me and inviting me into different work. And for me, both my kids, it's so much about their intimacy to the earth and the grief that they're feeling really deeply already around climate change. I'm like, oh, this is changing me. Like, I have a new posture and relationship to the earth. I see earthworms and songbirds differently. I feel that grief. I'm listening to the ways that they, you know, my 8-year-old's like, I can't eat beef anymore. And I can't eat cheese because I love the penguins. And like, and say, okay, like, how do we respond to that and do that differently? And I feel my heart shifting and my work shifting and my vocation shifting because of who they are and how they see the world and the love and grief that they're pouring out. And the ways that we change one another is just such a gift, and community allows that.
I'm sitting here thinking, like, if you were just dipping your toe into Christianity or into justice work, like that, if they feel like these big things. And I think what you were just saying is like, or just talk to your neighbor and like, yes, be open, yeah, to the possibility. Like, you know, like it does feel big. Like, you talk about climate change and it's like, holy, like, what do we do with that? But it's like, okay, how do you actually can take the step by just opening yourself up to conversation, to relationship. And it can be standing on your street while your toddler does a wheelie, you know, that's how yep, it goes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was going to say, it's again, absolutely, like, make connections, build relationships with people who are different than you, where you can learn from and you can experience, because that's where you grow in empathy. And, you know, we kind of go back to, too often, I think I want to go to what I know, right? Because that's the comfortable place. But it's not where I grow and learn and become a better parent with my child, right? It's pushing myself beyond that.
You talk about that in the book, like, our kids will lead us. So let your kids make the friends, and then you can just kind of swoop in.
Yep. Yep. But being able to give up enough power and let them make decisions and empower them in the family is really important.
Yeah.
And I think that relationship, you know, that sort of sense of meeting people who are different than us moves us into different spaces and vice versa. So like, also our neighbors loving us is going to change how they show up and for us. And there are moments where we're going to need that. And we know that we can be loved and cared for. And I think about that with my partner and I, when we got married in a church years ago, and we had folks in our neighborhood who never would have come to a same-sex wedding. Like, that would have just been totally outside of their religious or political sense, but they loved us because we knew them and we cared mm-hmm. for one another. And that's what changed, you know, how we show up for one another.
Yeah. Amen. Imagine that. Love your neighbors. Wonder where I heard that before. Where does that come from? Such a,
I think, Lydia, though, you do point, like, loving our neighbors and also allowing ourselves to be loved is like this vulnerability piece in that, and like honoring our own stories and lives enough to let other people in. And like, it's just this vulnerability connection that we got to let our guards down. We can't just expect everybody else to let their guards down. Like, we have to do that as well. And that's a good reminder of that.
Yeah. We're not meeting our neighbors to save them. We're meeting our neighbors to save ourselves and our community and the world. And
yeah, it goes back to being whole, right? We're whole when we're all together and when we are vulnerable and authentic and let people come in, and when we can go and be vulnerable and authentic to others, and then you're whole. But boy, is it so complicated. It seems like it should be so simple, but yet it feels so complicated for people.
Yeah. And it's just messy, and that's okay. Oh. And the more that the more vulnerable we are, the more we're willing to take the risks to talk about it, the more messy it's going to become. And we just have to honor and have gratitude for that mess.
What was the most complicated, or maybe not complicated, what was the most challenging, complicated, difficult part of the book process?
Oh, it was probably how to hold voices and how to just create space. It was like, I made a book proposal, and then I just kept adding more writers after I had a contract. Like, there's just more voices that I need in this book. And it was really important to have a multitude of experiences and diversity. So there's queer parents, there's grandparents, there's parents who are, you know, just having kids, there's Asian, Latino, Indigenous, Black parents, white parents, all of these sort of diversities. But I would still lie awake at night being like, oh, but there's five more parents I want to ask, and, you know, holding that sort of who's missing question. And I think that's still hard, and I still feel that. And I just have to know that this is one part of the conversation that's much wider, and all parents are doing brilliant and amazing things and could all write chapters. And we get to keep writing those. And this book is just a tiny piece of that offering and keeps growing in a much larger conversation.
I'm laughing because this is kind of, we're doing this series, What God Looks Like, and trying to show all these different showcases. And I do the same thing. I stay awake at night. I'm like, there are people missing from this picture. And then I call Dana and say, can we add one more? And she, you know, it might just have to be a part two. Like, we might have to have Sandbox Revolution part two, because at some point, but it is, it's so diverse, and there's so many stories, and there's so many ways in which God is reflected in justice work and in the work we're doing. So I was laughing because I feel your desire for that.
What was it like to read your dad's chapter?
Yeah, I love that I got to ask my dad to write a chapter. It's been so wonderful to have his voice. And I think there's all sorts of ways in the book that I think part of our work as parents is to look back on the ways that we were raised. And some of that is with gratitude, and some of that is also healing work around intergenerational trauma that continues to pass through. But having him in these pages, I think, is a real way of sort of honoring the ways that I grew up. And he writes about risk and resistance. So there's sort of all these moments around activism and civil disobedience or traveling to war zones where he's saying, there's a sort of mantra that's like, is this a gift or is it too much to ask? And I know that as a parent, I think that's something we often ask of, like, is this action that I'm taking good for my kids, or is it too much? But what I think has been so cool about reading it is to say, all right, now he's written this, but now I can look back, and there are ways that that question can actually be answered. And in every case, for me, it's that it was a gift, and that I am so glad that he made those choices. And I think that encourages me in my own parenting to say, sometimes it might seem hard or like too much, but to challenge myself to take risks and to tell the truth, and hope that in the long run, these are things that are going to be real gifts to my kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did the baptism piece has stayed with me so much. Your mom had written something about when you baptize your kids, like, it's not just some water on the kid's head. It's like giving them up to the work of God, which is beautiful, but calls us to something, right? And so yeah. I read that chapter like a week after I baptized my one-year-old. I was like, oh, right. Like this really is like something I'm giving them to God, like to yeah. do what God wants and what they want. And just like the like giving up of control, I think a little bit in the baptism ritual. Sacrament.
I think, and that's a hard thing for us humans to give up control. But I love the way you said that. Yeah.
But it was a struggle for your mom. Like it was a struggle yeah. for your parents. And I thought that was such an interesting perspective because so many people are like, let's get the kid baptized so they don't go to hell. And it's not what it is. And so it was just really appreciated that perspective. And then you get to hold that piece of your mom that you have that. Yeah. That's so beautiful. What would be your dream for the church? Like if there were like, what would be your dream that the church could actually be? Not there yet, but what could it be?
That's a great question. I think that my dreams for the church are that they're small, that they're on the margins, that they're built with deep relationships, that they take risks and that they want folks to be whole, that they tell the truth and struggle with the legacy and history of the church, that they're connected deeply with the earth, that they've got their hands in the dirt, that they're able to be honest about where we're headed to and knowing that that might mean changing or it might mean being able to be present to grief and dying and the pain that's to come and how do we love one another and be human in that journey that's to come.
That's very powerful.
I want to go to that church.
Yeah, I want to go to that. Do you have a worship experience now that you're engaged with? I mean, I know that we were in COVID, so I'm kind of curious to hear what it was like during COVID. And now that we're starting to come out of COVID, what does that worship experience look like?
Yeah, for a long time in COVID, I had a really hard time figuring out how to dive into Zoom. Church to me is so embodied and so place-based that to be on the screens was really hard. But lately, the last few months, my dad and I have been co-preaching around the Sandbox Revolution. So reflecting back generationally all over the country, we just keep Zoom hopping to different churches. And that's been so wonderful just to see the ways that communities are forming intimacy and prayer and getting to sort of be a fly on the wall in communities. But then the Catholic Worker has started doing Mass again outside on their lawn in the middle of this gentrifying neighborhood in Detroit, under the trees next to the turkeys and the chickens. And that's just been a delight to be able to be outside with people again and to have Mass and to be with people that I've been doing this with for decades.
Well, I like that. You covered all three issues right there. I think I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so excellent. Curious what church will look like on the other side of the pandemic, like both mm-hmm. how yeah. technology will continue yeah. or the way we think about embodied theology. And then also what we've learned, like this is not going to be the last crisis that we face. And so what do we wish we had done before the pandemic to be ready to love one another through it?
Gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Lydia, we're so grateful for your time and the book that just has given us so much to Dana and I go back and forth talking about it. It is a book to do in community for us to kind of reimagine or think about some of the ways that we can parent or just slightly shift or totally shift the ways that we talk with our children about the world and create them to be justice warriors. So we're so grateful for your work and your time. And we hope that this is not the last conversation, but that we get to have an ongoing talk with you. So thank you so much.
That'll be wonderful. I would love to do that. Thanks to you both. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lydia. Thank you. I look forward to continuing to build this relationship with you.
That sounds great. I would love that.
Thank you so much for listening. Just like everyone we are interviewing throughout this series reflects the sacred and holy image of God, so do you. Together, we are what God looks like.
The Collective Table is supported by San Diego United Methodist Church in Encinitas, California.
A big thank you to the team at Castos, especially our producer Stuart Barefoot and our content editor Claire Watson.
The original music heard in this episode was created and performed by Mystic Mercy.
Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, YouTube channel, and our newsletter.
If you'd like to financially support the work of The Collective Table, please visit thecollectivetable.org. There you can also find out more about who we are and view past episodes.